Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
You can't win anything with kids.
I would love it if we beat them. Love it.
How much are the players looking forward to Arsene Wenger arriving?
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Phoenix Five. We've been lucky enough to be joined by a very special guest in Mr. Ian Walker, a Spurs homegrown talent who's played over 312 times for Spurs before moving on to make over 100 appearances with Leicester and now currently in China as one of the goalkeeping coaches or specialist goalkeeping coaches, should I say. I'm on my own this week due to it being a Sunday and obviously we're interviewing Ian Walker in China. It's a Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning here. And what time is it there, Ian? Mid-afternoon now, late afternoon?
It's almost 6:45 in the evening. So
lovely. Yeah. Well, that's good. How are you, first of all?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, very good. Life's treating me well so far, so it's all good. Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to start in China. You've been in there since 2014 and you stayed quite a while. You're obviously still there now, which is quite rare. A lot of people went to China in the peak of the explosion of the league and the wealth coming into Chinese football. You had like players like Tevez going out there, you had Oscar, and then Charlie Oakway, we interviewed Gus Poyet. Quite a lot of people went out there, but they all came home within 2-3 years. What made you decide to stay?
Well, I mean, I actually came out when just after Nicholas Anelka came out here. So as a 2012. Well, pretty much I wasn't doing anything at the time. So I was like, well, there was an opportunity as a goalkeeping coach. And I thought, well, it would be a good chance to test myself and all that kind of thing. And would it be in China too? It's kind of an unknown. So, you know, I like to travel. I like to have new experiences. So I thought, well, why not? Let's give it a go. And things went well. I was at Shanghai Shenhua first. And fortunately for me, their goalkeeper got into the China national squad. And then after a couple of years, I moved to the team I'm at now, which was Shanghai East Asia. Then they changed their name to Shanghai SIPG, and now we're Shanghai Port. And again, things went well here. The goalkeeper here is, he's now actually the number one goalkeeper in China national team. So again, things went quite well. And I've just ended up staying. So it's been a really good experience. Something I'd recommend for all coaches to go abroad and test yourself abroad and get out of your comfort zone a little bit. Of course, there's lots of challenges, but overall, it's been a really great experience.
Brilliant. I mean, in China, when the explosion of the Chinese A-League kind of went off, goalkeepers are one of the positions. I don't think they were allowed to sign goalkeepers. It was one of the stipulations that they couldn't sign goalkeepers because they wanted to create goalkeepers because it's such a specialist position. How have you seen a development in goalkeepers from when you started to now? Because I imagine the quality has gone up in terms of goalkeeping when you first started to now. Have you noticed that being more coaches being out and more of a specialist role?
Of course the level's gone up. I would say that the there needs to be more done as far as, and this is just general in Chinese football, I think, is the grassroots level being you know, set up properly, and then having more coaches at that level, and then bringing through a better quality of player. But there's a lot of short-term things going on as football in China, and it's been a little bit slow, I would say. Could be done a little bit quicker, but in general, yeah, the goalkeepers are getting better. We've had, there's been a few different foreign coaches, goalkeeper coaches, a couple of Germans and a few other guys, the Spanish, have been here, and you can see that the goalkeepers are getting better. But again, I think the problem is at the grassroots level, because, you know, we're used to training outside of the ball at like 5 years old, you know, kicking a ball around and all that. And there isn't really that much of that here. It's not really in their culture. So you really have to develop it properly in the academy, and the academies aren't really anywhere close to the level that we're used to in Europe. And I think, you know, the coaching level needs to improve as well. But, you know, it's a slow process, but hopefully eventually they'll get there. And when they do, then we'll see a lot higher level of player. But the reason I got here in the first place is because of that, you know, to develop the goalkeepers. You're developing goalkeepers at 20 years old and 22 years old instead of, you know, they've had some coaching, but you have to change them. You know, you have to change a lot of their technical stuff because they haven't been, you know, they haven't been coached perhaps in the right way, or they haven't known how to do it properly. And you're always tweaking it. Even, you know, even with a national team goalkeeper now, I'm still trying to change a few little things on him. So, and he's 30 years old. So, you know, it's a bit of a process, but you don't get them at 10 years old or whatever, where you can get that good foundations and good basics in at that age. So it's a challenge, but it's a good challenge.
What's the language barrier like? Do you speak Chinese now, or is it kind of through interpretation?
It's mainly through interpretation. It's still like that. When I was younger, I used to dive around still and show them what to do and stuff like that. Obviously now those days are gone. but I mean, it's easy enough. Those we communicate easily with the guys. Some guys speak English. I don't speak that much Chinese, but I speak a bit of it, so we get through it all right.
Well, let's start back at the beginning of your career. Obviously, as a goalkeeper, concentration, the mental focus. How do you deal with that, like, mental side of the game when you was playing with things like fans chanting at you? I mean, you was famously confronted by a Leicester fan during the back end of your career. How do you deal with that mental side of the game?
Well, for me, it was like just about the preparation, really. I mean, if I felt like I had covered everything in training and I, you know, had focused on it in training from the previous game through the week to the next game, then I always felt confident going into that game. If I'd done everything correctly and I'd felt like, yeah, I'm ready for this. As far as the rest of it is just, you know, Ray Clements always told me that, you know, you might only get one or two. He was the one who really drilled it into me. You only have one or two things to do a game, and you need to, you know, you need to keep that focus. And he was, you know, fantastic at it, obviously, when he had his career at Liverpool and also with England and stuff. So I was lucky to have him as kind of like a mentor. And like you say, the goalkeeper is somebody who's expected to make the saves, but you might only have one or two things to do. And if you let your concentration wander, or you're, for some reason in that game, you're maybe not feeling 100% confident or something like that, then you can make an error and then you're the villain for the whole piece for however long it is till the next game comes along and then you can try and rectify it. So yeah, it's a difficult position, but it's a great position because you can, you know, the game can be in your hands literally. So you have a massive influence on what happens, and that's something you have to enjoy. At times it's a bit trying, but like you said, that's where the mental strength comes in, and you have to have thick skin, be able to overcome, you know, all sorts of things that are going to be thrown your way, because you know you're going to make mistakes. I mean, every goalkeeper in the world makes mistakes, so you have to learn to live with it and try and perform at a high level week in, week out, which is not easy.
What was the best in terms of being in the goal, like chance you had against you? I mean, I was going from some of the forums and listening to some of the chances some of the fans remember chanting. Is there any particular chance that stuck out to you that either affected you, like distracted you slightly, or you just thought that's quite a good bit of banter, that one?
Well, I always had comments about my hair and all that, which are the wig, you know, the old wig. I still got it.
It's still looking good, but now.
I just stuck it on just now. So. I used to get a lot about that, you know, where's your caravan and all that kind of stuff, and people shout at me to get my hair cut and la la la, which is whatever. I was like, just okay. That just became old hat after a little while. I had some good kind of one-on-one banter with some fans behind the goal every now and again, which is quite nice. You know, I like that. It was good. And then there was also some, I can't remember exactly what game it was, but I had some things. My mother died in during the season, and I had some fans, some very, very few, just a few fans that made a comment about that, which wasn't very nice. But I wanted to climb into the stands. If I'd had a chance, I probably would have gone for it. But but in the majority of it, it's all lighthearted stuff. And, you know, if you just return it with a smile, I mean, there's not a lot that they can really do. So it's part of the game. I mean, obviously not everybody's going to be very complimentary. So a lot of people want to try, obviously away fans, they want to try and get under your skin. But you know that, so you just have to, laugh it off or just ignore it. Most of the time you're so focused on the game you don't really hear it anyway. It's just when, you know, there's a break in play or something, you go to grab a water bottle or something like that, you might hear something. But I mean, unless there's a whole stand singing something about you, then, you know, it's pretty much you can just pretty much ignore it. You're concentrating on the game too much.
Does it seep in a bit more if you make a mistake and then you're getting the fans on your back? That then, you know, you make a mistake, fans are on your back, and then you're in the goal alone. It's one of the most loneliest places in the world when you're in a goal and you made a mistake and there's no one around you apart from 10,000 fans shouting something pretty horrible behind you. Does that affect your focus a bit more because you're thinking, I've made a mistake, now they're on me back, I can hear everyone a bit more? It heightens your senses, or do you just block them out and go, I've got to focus straight back on the game?
Well, especially when it's your home, when your own fans are doing it, it's pretty hard to ignore it. I had that a couple of times in my career where, you know, if I made a mistake or I wasn't in a particularly good run of form and I made a mistake. And then I think that's what hurt more, when your home fans, get on your back. And that's pretty tough to deal with. I found it tough to deal with anyway. I couldn't just ignore it, although I did my best to just ignore it. But then obviously you have to try to prove them wrong. I mean, you have to try to get back. Number one, get your form back, or get your performances back to where it's a level where it should be when you're playing at not only playing for a football club, but playing at one of the bigger clubs. So, you know, expectation is always there, and if you're not at your standards, you have to try and fight your way back through, you know, training and getting yourself back in. And when you get an opportunity to prove that you're worthy of your place in the team, Yeah, I mean, I've seen it happen to other players as well, and it's not nice. I don't, you know, but I knew what it felt like, and it's a pretty, I think that's the worst thing of all, your home fans, you know, booing you or saying things, you know, shouting at you, doing this kind of things to you, and it's, that's the tough one. That is definitely a tough one. Away fans, you know, okay, they're gonna give you a bit of stick no matter what. I mean, I remember after like the Italy game when I played for England, and then the next game was a North London derby. I mean, so, you know, imagine the stick I got there. And, you know, it was good for me though, because I knew that I focused so much on the training that week, and like, okay, I knew it was a huge game and I just wanted to play well, you know, and everything. And I we ended up drawing 0-0 and I played quite well, but, you know, it's really, it was really an interesting time, because I kind of like, at the end of that game, I was like, okay, I you know, mentally I was strong enough to get through it. You know, I was quite happy in the end that I came through a tough test and I survived it. You know, that was what I was doing really in that game, was just to try and survive it and to play well and try to show people it didn't affect me. And you know, when it was 0-0, obviously I felt like, okay, now I can move on.
So when you make a great save, knowing you've won 3 points, you've single-handedly won 3 points for your team, let's say, does that give you a massive, do you feel bigger, do you grow?
I think we had a few runs at Spurs where we kept like five clean sheets in a row, you know, over time, it was two or three seasons, I think. And during that time, I felt like I was never going to let another goal in. I mean, the confidence, you know, people talk about being in the zone. I mean, I think that's, it's hard to explain, but it's, I think the confidence level is so high and the belief in yourself is so high that every game, I mean, I just felt like I wasn't going to let one in. And the when you eventually do let one in, it's like, oh, it's like, you know, it's like, I didn't let one in. You know, it's like, it's a big shit. It comes as a kind of a bit of a shock. It's like, oh, I let one in. I can't believe it. And it was like, you know, so those are like the dream times to play in goal. It's like, you know, you're just, again, so I say it's hard to explain. Everyone talks about the zone. I imagine that's what it felt. That's what it was. And, you know, you're making saves and you just feel, you know, on top of everything. And then they're the greatest times. You're just hoping they're never going to stop, and you don't feel like they're going to stop, but of course, eventually they do. And then, you know, like you're talking about there, on the other side of it, you know, you make a mistake, and then all of a sudden, you feel like nervous. You don't, you know, you're not confident. You feel like, you know, you're in yourself. You're not playing as well as you should, or you should say things, and you're not. And then that's the horrible side of it. That's just completely opposite side. It's like, you know, let's say you make a mistake, you just want the ground to swallow you up. You just want the referee to blow the whistle and say, all right, let's go, that's it. But
the locker room, yeah, like, after an incident like that, because obviously, again, if a defender gives the ball away and concedes a goal, you know, could make a tackle to stop a goal, a striker could miss a chance, score again. And in the locker room, you can redeem yourself as a goalkeeper in a game. If you've made a mistake that's caused you to lose the game, what was it like going into a locker room? Did you have the support? Or was there a couple of times where a certain defender, you feel free to name someone, or a manager would dig you out for a mistake?
I mean, I always felt like I needed to apologise when I made a mistake. Because I just felt like, the problem with me is, or what was my problem is, I always thought I was a bit of a perfectionist, where I just felt I should do everything right. And that caused me a lot of problems because I always fell below the standard. So for myself. So like, you know, no matter what everybody else would say, I'd already said it to myself and more. So I always felt like I went in and always apologized. If I felt like I cost the team, I would always apologize to the lads, because I know they, you know, worked hard and that to try and get the result. Yeah, I mean, on very few occasions there was maybe somebody that would say something, but very rare. There was one where we played Man United, I think, at home, and David Beckham got one out, got scored a goal. It was about 30 yards, 35 yards out, something like that. You know, he got it on your right foot and just bent it, and it went away and went in top corner. And
it was an FA Cup game, I think that was, if I'm right.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, it wasn't really I didn't feel it was my fault. I thought, like, there's a long way out, maybe, you know. In my mind, I was like, oh, maybe I could have got it. And then afterwards, because we talked about closing his right foot, making sure we closed down his right foot. And he obviously got it on his right foot. No one closed him down. So I had a little pop, and then someone had a pop at me. It's just like a normal kind of back and forth thing in a dressing room when you're not winning, I guess. But for me, it wasn't, yeah, that was one of the only times. I mean, it wasn't really a mistake. I mean, and the other one would be the England-Italy game, like I said before. But because the England-Italy game was, my first game, I was very nervous in that game. I'm not going to say I wasn't very nervous in that game. And it didn't go our way, you know, as you know. And a lot of people kind of blame you for the goal and this and that. And but afterwards, it was quite interesting because, you know, me and Gazza were kind of like quite close at that time, and he was there. And, you know, I found it like quite interesting that at that point, it was more of an individual, everybody looking after themselves, is what I found from that experience. Rather than now, I would say it's probably, you know, it seems like it's more of a squad, everyone together kind of thing. So that kind of I don't know, I wouldn't say it put me off, but it kind of like opened my eyes a little bit to the way things are. So, but not really, it wasn't really any criticism there from the players, but I think that was a kind of not a great experience anyway. Apart from playing for England, of course, playing for England was great. I mean, I would never change that for anything.
Well, we're talking about going on to England, as you brought it up. You managed to win 4 England caps. You played under 21 and for England B. And then after Euro 96, you wasn't called up again until 2004. Do you think that was justified at the time? Do you think that Italy, that was obviously the Italy game, the Italy game was your last game, I believe, that you played as a competitive game in the squad until 2004. Yes. What was your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, look, David Seaman was about a level above everybody else. Obviously, I think he was injured or something. And then, you know, maybe some people thought I didn't deserve to play in the game. I don't know. That's probably it. But I think anybody that was playing in that game, if they'd made a mistake, then obviously I think they would have got the same treatment. It's just that I was there and it happened and that's it. So do I think it's justified that all the stuff afterwards? You're playing for England, so you kind of half expect it. I think it was pretty poor defending all round, but I'm the goalkeeper and I'm supposed to keep the ball out of the net and I didn't. So you have to take that. You have to take that on the chin. That's that's how it is. So you know, listen, I knew I had to be, you know, top, you know, not make any mistakes, do all that kind of stuff, and you know, it happened. So then I got a bit of a backlash, but and that's okay from fans and everything else, it's okay. But then I got a few things that were like, you know, happened at my house and stuff like that, which wasn't really acceptable. But I didn't really say much about it. I just kept it to myself and then just try to get on with it.
I mean, we'll go on to that in a second. I will talk about that because I think it's quite an important part of being a goalkeeper or any position in playing a professional football when you've got fans that follow you. But I mean, at the same time, there was Nigel Martin, there was Tim Flowers, Kevin Press. I don't think we've ever had such an array of talented goalkeepers. Mentally, how did you tell the club about what happened at your house, or was it just kept completely to yourself when things happened after that?
I was just cutting it out a little bit there. But you're talking about the house stuff. I don't know if I told the club or not, but I think I did. And then we had to have some security there for a while afterwards. Not much fun, but I pretty much didn't go out for ages. Actually, I did go out straight away. I wanted to front it. So I went out straight away, actually, after that. The day after the game, I went out and I just wanted to get out there because I didn't want to hide away like a hermit. so from that point of view, I just wanted to front it up. But some people just, you know, take it too far, don't they? So I mean, there's not much you can do about it. I mean, that's probably why people, you know, moan now that they don't interact with players, is because, you know, the players the players want to keep away from people who take it too far. Unfortunately, that kills them. You know, that kills the majority of people who are good supporters and all that, and who appreciate the players. But there's always a minority, and in everything that want to make it difficult for everybody else. So, you know, that's the reality of the world we live in, unfortunately.
So we'll go back right to the beginning now. So you started your career as at Spurs as a trainee. You work your way up with Pat Jennings, as you mentioned, and also went on to win an FA Youth Cup in the 90s. Have you always been a Spurs fan? How did you get into football? What led you to be a goalkeeper? Tell us the backstory of Ian Walker.
All right, well, my dad played in goal for Watford and York, Reading, and then Colchester. So I always used to go and watch him play when he was at Colchester. So I already was following him around. And then we used to always watch matches on the TV and stuff like that as well. And he used to tell me, you know, about Ray Clements and his other favourite was Dino Zoff. So I used to watch a lot of Liverpool. And so I kind of ended up being a Liverpool fan because I was watching them all the time. And plus they were winning everything at the time. So I was a bit of a, you know, I was following the team that was winning. But I used to watch a lot of Ray Clements when he was playing. And then, so we were living in a small village near Colchester. And then I went to Queen's Park Rangers on Monday nights to train. and I was 13. And then I got trials for Lillishaw, which was the national school. So I went up there, did all the trials, and eventually I got through. So there was myself and another goalkeeper called Gary French, who I think he was at Southampton. And then end up just going there for 2 years. Gary actually, he dropped out after 3 months. So I was the only goalkeeper, and I had Mike Kelly, who was the goalkeeping coach, who also has been the goalkeeping coach for England. And he was brilliant for me. You know, he worked me so hard for 2 years. It was crazy. But, you know, we played all the local academies every weekend, and then we'd have some international games where obviously all the scouts came and all that kind of stuff, watched the games. And then eventually I had a pick of a few clubs, and my dad had already taken me to White Hart Lane to watch a game, a night game actually. And, during that time, and I kind of just looked around the place, and I was like, this is great. Oh, this is a place. So this is where I want to be, if I got the opportunity, that was. But and then luckily for me, it came up. So at 16, I ended up going to Spurs and signing apprenticeship forms, getting 29, was it 29.50 a week, which was great. And so I did that. And I've been very lucky, really, because I say I had Mike Kelly at the beginning, obviously my dad as well, but we really didn't do that much kind of coaching and stuff. I mean, I remember the one time we did kind of, I ended up, he was smashing the ball at me, you know, and I was ended up in tears, I think. So it didn't go down too well. But and then I had Ray Clements there, and then I had Pat Jennings, which was great as the coaches. And after that, Hans Sagers was there, who was really good as well. You know, I had a lot of belief in myself and where I was going. So I was pretty single-minded in that, and just seemed to go for me. You know, I think I had 7 or 8 goalkeepers in front of me when I first joined the Spurs. And by the time I was 19, I think I made my debut. So it was pretty...
contract in 89 and was number 2 behind Eric Torsthorpe. And you went from a number 2 to number 1 in only, I think it was 3 years, more or less, which is quite a young age compared to how goalkeeping back then was. A lot of young goalkeepers didn't seem to come through as young as that. You had a really good debut season. So what was the change like from being a number 2 to a number 1 between you and the now number 2? How was that relationship?
Well, I mean, in my mind, I was always a number 1. So, I mean... But I think that's the way you have to be. I mean, that's the way I was. I thought I was just like, well, this guy's in my way, and I'm like, I think I'm better than him. So that's how I thought. I mean, that is how I thought. Somewhere on the line, that sometimes changed. That changed a little bit, but at that point, it was that's how I felt all the way through. As soon as I joined Spurs, I thought I was better than all of them, and I know I wasn't better than all of them, but I in my mind, I thought I was better than all of them, and I knew that I was going to get there, and that's the mindset I had, and that's. That's just how it was. And then so, you know, I got through, I did all the things, you know, I went on loan to Ipswich and I went on loan to Oxford, which was really great for my development. And then I, you know, obviously you start in the youth team, and we had a very successful youth team. We won the FA Youth Cup, and then you get jumped up to reserves after, I think, I don't know, maybe a year, I started playing in reserves, and that was going well. And then you start, you know, you're training with the first team, then they start getting you in with the first team, and you see, okay, yeah, I can handle this. You know, you get tested. Back in those days, you know, you used to get tested by the players. You know, they used to come late on you with tackles and bash into you and all that and see if you could handle it, you know, because you're the youngster. And
you was know, it this particularly was hard on you when you come up? Because we spoke to other pros, and obviously some people come from the YTS, some people just went straight from an academy. Now it's a completely different world of how you go from a school kid to a pro contract. But back then it was a bit, as you said, leaving a bit on you and a bit more physical, a bit more, you know, testing your mentality as well. Was there anything that prepared you for that? Or was there anything that anything you remember, a certain player who was a bit niggly? Or, because obviously you're a young kid, you're coming in, and was you quite arrogant at that age, would you say? If you thought you was number one, did it come off as a bit of arrogance to people, or was you still quite reserved?
No, I don't think I was arrogant. It was just, I wouldn't go outwards. I just, it was in a belief. It wasn't like me going around going, oh yeah, I'm the best and all that. And telling people like some people do, but no, that's not, that wasn't my way. I'm quiet, pretty quiet, pretty reserved, but within my, you know, within my mind of where I wanted to go and what I was going to do and belief in myself, that was more of an inward thing. But I mean, I remember Gazza rolling over me once when I got the ball and like, you know, roughing me up in the back of the goal. Yeah, try. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's a bit rough, but okay, it's a test to see how I do. So you just jump back up and just get on with it, you know, stuff like that. And there's a lot of stuff that they you know, in the dressing room and all that as well. There's always, of course, a lot of stuff that goes on there that they try and test you a little bit. But that's, you know, let's just see how, like you said, see how your character is. How's your mentality? You know, can you handle it? And some people can, I guess. Most people can, but some people can't. They find it difficult. But for me, yeah, it was all part of it. I've been around dressing rooms and that, you know, when I was with my dad watching the games and all that. And so I was kind of used to all the thing of what goes on. So for me, it was okay, no problem. And then the getting into the first team squad was, you know, obviously just a natural progression, really. And then you know, okay, well, I'm almost where I want to be. And it's just a matter of keep going, keep training hard, keep trying to do the right things. And when you do get a chance to play, you know, show that you can handle it. So, you know, and that's what it was. So it was, getting into the first team, of course, every time you step up, it's a little bit nerve wracking. You know, you're a little bit nervous. I don't know, maybe there's some players that are, but for me, I was still a little bit nervous. And even when I played, you know, 100 games or whatever, I still had a little bit of nervousness before I went out. But I knew that was like, kind of like, okay, you're ready. If I didn't have that, then I'd feel like, you know, I wasn't really ready for the game. I felt like it was something that was just natural for me. But yeah, going into those first games, I think Terry Venables played me in the game, one of the games before the cup final in 91, the build up, because he was resting a lot of the players and that went quite well. I think we lost the game to Norwich, but it went quite well. I was quite happy with it and kind of felt like I didn't let myself down, showed that I could handle it. And then from there, I just started getting more games and everything was great.
You know, we always have parents on the sidelines that are quite pushy. What was your dad like to be, obviously going from a goalkeeper him being a goalkeeper and then you going into being a goalkeeper, how was it pressurized? You've got now, Peter Schmeichel and Kasper Schmeichel, how their relationship is. What was yours and your dad's relationship at that time?
Well, it was totally my decision what I wanted to say. I mean, originally, obviously watching him play and following all that, I knew early on it was something I wanted to do. But I was a striker when I was like 8, 9. And then I decided, right.
Everyone's a striker. A 8 and 9.
8 and 9. I just decided I wanted to be a goalkeeper. And they were like, what are you talking about? So I used to score quite a lot of goals for my young side, but I knew like I wanted to be a goalkeeper. So I moved to actually one of the bigger clubs in Colchester. And they said, all right, we want you to be the goalkeeper. So I went to them and then, I never got any pressure from my dad or whatever he was just, you know, my mum was very supportive, and my dad was pretty like, you know, yeah, if this is what you want to do, then that was it. But the thing is, he'd come to my games on like a Sunday and then he'd be like, oh yeah, you should have done this better. You should have done that better. he was always like, you know, I never heard anything like, oh, you did really well, you know, or whatever. It was always like the mistake. So, you know, it was pretty tough, but, you know, I guess he wanted the best for me and all that. It was just his way of trying to get me to improve, I guess. But, yeah, they never pressured me to do it. Everything was my decision, you know. My mum, like I said, my mum was always super supportive and my dad was kind of like, he never really said that much to me as far as praising, but I found out from one of his old teammates, he's very proud of you and all that, what you've done. So, but he doesn't really say it to me himself. So it was like, okay.
I think it was the way he was back then. Maybe, well, not back then, I think maybe now, but I think a lot of fathers, I've got 3 daughters, I haven't got any sons, but I can definitely understand. So I tell my kids all the time, you know, when they do things well and the support side of it. But I imagine back then, is it more kept in house, wasn't it? As you said, you found out through someone. What about when you made your England debut? He must have been super proud of that. He must have. Did he say anything to kind of reaffirm at that moment? Was there a moment there, or was it kind of only on the it was just the mistakes?
No, not really. I think, yeah, of course he was proud and all that, and yeah, I'm sure he's proud of, you know, that I, you know, managed to get to a level that I did and all that. But no, I think that was one of the games. I think that might be one of the games where I found out, you know, that, oh, you know, he's super proud of you and all that. So yeah, he didn't really say anything. Even now, we don't really, like, you know, the emotional side of it, don't really, he doesn't really come into it, you know, and the feelings, you know, and all that kind of stuff. He's quite, you know, he's brought up, is a single kid with his dad was in the army. So I think maybe that was the way, you know, that's just the way it was. So, yeah. You know, I understand that and that's how it is. But I think, you know, then I knew, you know, I found from somebody, I found out somebody else that, you know, how we felt about it. So that was it. That was good enough for me. It was great. So
back to Spurs then. So, and then you had quite a few managers over that time that you was there. Who was the best and why, and who was the worst and why?
Blimey. Well, I'd probably say Terry Venables was the best.
Man management, would you say? Because his man management was, from people we spoke to, his man management was one of the, that's what he was known for, really. Was that, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'd say because your man management, and obviously he gave me massive opportunities as well, you know, kind of played in my first games and things like that. And then later on, I was in Euro 96. So, you know, he was very good to me as well. But aside from that, yeah, his man management skills were really good. And then, yeah, I mean, we changed almost like, it felt like it was every year we changed managers. So, but yeah, that was a good period. And then, you know, I liked all the coaches. It's just like, you know, some of them, we had more success than others. Some more interesting characters than others. Yeah, I like Jerry Francis. I thought he was good, and I thought. And then we have the Aussie was, you know, Aussie was a funny character. You know, we had the famous like five forwards, five forwards of him. So I wasn't totally happy with that situation, but it was like, you know, we'd attack with all the players, and then they'd come running back and they'd attack us, and it would be like 5-3, or, you know, we'd lose like 4-3, or it was like that. But I mean, it was entertaining, that's for sure, but it wasn't that successful, unfortunately. It would have been great if it would have been. And I think, you know, Christian Gross, he struggled with his whole, you know, I think from the beginning with the old train ticket thing that he had at the press conference and all that kind of stuff.
With the Gross one, sorry to interrupt, but I really have to ask, the players would have seen that. So had he already lost the player from that point, do you reckon, from that press conference? Was he on a upward battle from then on out, would you say? Because Rule Fox liked him. We spoke to Rule Fox.
Yeah.
And said, tactically, he was fantastic, but the lads didn't buy into him, was what he was alluding to. Would you agree with that then?
Yeah, I think that's difficult for him after that, because it was so out there from what we used to see in press conferences and that. And then also he tried to do some different things, which I think nowadays, we probably didn't accept it as well. Like, you know, getting up for this, what was it used to be called? Pre-game training or something. It was like 7 in the morning, and like Jürgen Klinsmann was getting up and getting Jürgen out of bed at 7 on a match day. He probably wasn't too happy with it. And few things happened between him and Jürgen as well, so that kind of set him back a little bit too. So I think a few things happened like that, and then of course ultimately it's about winning matches, and it just didn't really happen. So I think in the end it was just different. Everybody just, you know, it was kind of different, and the way it started and all that. And I think, you know, that's why it's looked upon as a failure. But, you know, from, like I said, Rule thought he was good, and I didn't have a problem with him personally or anything like that. I mean, it was just different, you know, it was just different for everybody, and he had some bumps in the road.
He was definitely your harshest critic. Some of the quotes I've seen online from him, you know, calling a player out back then was a bit more common, I would say, than it is now. You can't do it now because everyone's completely in a bubble. But back then, one of the things was, you know, he called you lazy and regretted playing you. Did you pull him up on this? Because these are public comments.
Well, yeah, obviously that's personal, but I mean, doesn't mean I agreed with what he said. I don't know. Maybe he just, who knows why he wanted to single me out. But yeah, of course there was games where I didn't play that well and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, if he felt that way, he probably should have dropped me then. That's all I have to think about it. He's going to keep picking me, don't I? Then it's a bit weird that he would say something like that. But no, I mean, for me, it's like, yeah, it's like you just got to get on with it. Whether you know, sometimes people say things and they're right. Sometimes they say things and you think they're wrong. And it's not, for me, it's like no big personal, I didn't take it personally. It's just like, you know, you're entitled to what you want to say and it's fine. There's no issue between myself and him because I actually, actually somebody asked me if I could try and get him a job in China. So yeah, I mean, you know, people under pressure and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, when he was under huge pressure there, no doubt about it. You know, sometimes say things, sometimes you know, maybe he regrets saying it now, who knows, but I haven't really spoken to him about it. And that's fine. Like I said, his opinion is his opinion. And that was it.
At Spurs, obviously, had a lot of players that would be characters, which certainly we don't have in football as much anymore. Well, they're not really allowed to be seen as characters anymore. At your time at Spurs, what were the three craziest players?
I mean, I know loads of people got Gazza stories, so that's kind of, you know. I mean, I stayed with him for a year in Cromwell Road, so in a hotel in Cromwell Road. I think it was a Swallow. It was a Swallow anyway. I made it change name. But, yeah, it's funny because I was living in Cheshunt in a ground floor apartment, and then I was getting a bit of hassle there as well. So I ended up trying to sell it, and then he came back. He joined Spurs, and then he was staying in London. And then he said to me one day, "Oh, you know, because I think Gazza, you know, he doesn't like to be alone. So he said, "Oh, do you want to come? You can come and stay with me in a hotel in London." I was like, "You sure?" He's like, "Yeah." I was like, "All right." So ended up getting me a room in the Cromwell Road there in the hotel. And he used to drive me in and out to training every day, and we used to just hang out. And this was after the World Cup, so he was like, everybody was Gazza crazy, you know. So he ended up taking me to like private events here, private events there, you know, dragging me around. And of course, I was loving it as a young kid, like, you know, absolutely loving it. But everywhere we go, he'd be, you know, we'd go somewhere, anywhere, like you could go to the Hard Rock and eat, or you do something, and next thing you know, there's a bottle of champagne on the table, you know, and people are just buying him drinks left, right, and center. It was absolutely mad. So that was an amazing experience after the World Cup. And he, you know, people get all these mad, you know, Gazza's mad and Gazza's just that. Yeah, sure, he's a little bit out there, he does some wacky stuff, but he's got a heart of gold, you know, he'd do anything for anybody. And, you know, there's all stories about, you know, the ostrich he let out of the training ground and, you know, all the stuff. He just was constantly, yeah, I mean, you come into training when we were at, was it Spurs Lodge, the one before that? Yeah, it might be Spurs Lodge. And, you know, there'd be a bench outside and he'd be sitting on the bench, you know, with no clothes on, just having a cup of tea. You know, not everybody would be walking by. And, you know, all the ladies who work in the offices and all that. And he'd just be sitting on the thing like this with a cup of tea and nothing on. He'd always be the prankster, like, you know, always. Eric always had a big reaction to everything. So, like, you know, they'd cut the ends off his socks. You know, the usual stuff, cut the ends off his socks. They'd put, like, DP in his underpants. You know, and one day he pooped in his gloves, and Eric, you know, he just was chasing them around. As him and Vinny Samways, they were like chased. Eric was like, you know, because Eric was a man mountain. You know, he was like really, and he was chasing them all around the training ground, trying to catch them. So but it was an everyday thing. It wasn't like, you know, it was an everyday thing. He'd have crazy bets with Steve Sedgley, you know, about if he would eat the blue thing in the urinal,
I've heard some rumors about it. Tell that. Do you know that story? Tell that story. Well, I've heard some rumors about it.
I might get it wrong, but I think. Well, so basically, it's, you know, I'm not sure the whole story, but Gazza bet Steve Sedgley he wouldn't eat the little blue, you know, whatever in the urinal. So Sedge, not being Sedge, said yeah. So I think it's like £1,000 back then or something like that. So I bet you £1,000 won't do it. Yeah, so I bet you won't do it. And so yeah, I will. So anyway, he did it. And then Gazza wrote him a check for £1,000 and Sedge ate that as well. So he just, it was like that. And he had so many about of him, like even with the England squad, you know, in Euro 96, like, so it's the first time really I've got into a major tournament and I'm one room and Gazza's next door. So, yeah, he's ringing me up at like all hours saying, oh, do you fancy a bottle of wine? And I was like, no, I can't. I mean, you know, I mean, the first time I'm in the squad, I can't do that and all that. So he's just how he was. I mean, there's so many stories about him. Just funny. There's one actually with, I think it was after the Scotland game. And it's at Burnham Beaches and like, at the end of the lawn, there's the TV marquee. So whenever the players or Venners, they wanted a live interview or whatever, you had to go up the end, all the way up the end and do the interview. And your back would be to the hotel, but you could see all the lights at the end. So anyway, after one of the games, it was Venners like said, right, but guys, you can have a drink because you have a drink in the bar. You know, we deserve it, la, la, la. So all the players are down there everything, watching TV, and it's on the TV. It says, after the break, a live interview with Terry Vanderbos. So all of a sudden they go, right. Someone said, like, oh, Gazza, I bet you don't run up there and get in behind Venders when he's doing the interview and all that. So yeah, everyone's had a few drinks. So Gazza goes, yeah, of course I will. So anyway, comes off the break and we're all watching the TV and Gazza disappears. So anyway, we're watching the TV, then all of a sudden you can just see this figure zigzagging up the lawn, and exactly like this. And then as it comes into focus, well, it's slightly in focus, you can't see it, but you just see a body with a pair of boxer shorts over his head. And that's it. And he runs up behind, runs off screen. And we're all cracking up in the bar, we're all cracking up. But I've never seen any footage of it anywhere. I've never seen it on YouTube. I've told loads of people about it and they can't find anything about it.
What about Klinsmann then? What was he like? Because he was one of the first big foreign names to come over from abroad. What was he like in the dressing room? What was, in terms of obviously the English culture and German culture is very different, maybe professionalism wise. How did he take to pranks and stories and things like that? How was your time with him?
I think we were away pre-season, I think, when he signed, and then he flew in, and of course we were allowed out after training or whatever, so we were all in a bar and he turned up in the bar and then just put his credit card behind the bar straight away. So I mean, it straight away everybody loves him, you know.
he's
read it so well, so everyone's like, oh, he's played that really well. So everybody loved him, and he was just a great guy. Yeah, I mean he, you know, he drove his little Beetle and all that, and everybody knew he, you know, he had like three Porsches in his home and wherever it was. But he was just such a nice guy, you know, just a really nice guy, easy to get along with, you know, worked hard as just top class striker. You can see that straight away. Just an easygoing guy, and it was a brilliant time at the club because obviously to have someone like that signed for you and just see him in training and then what he did in the games and all that was brilliant to see. So it was a great experience for me as well, as like, well, playing with a real, you know, top class striker. But he was a great person as well. And he definitely lifted the club when he came twice, actually, when he came twice. So just good things about him. I'm not sure anyone had the balls to like you know, cut his socks off and all that, though. I don't think anybody did that. Not that I know of, anyway. I think he was left alone.
Who is the, apart from Gazza then, who was the best in the locker room outside of Gazza?
Oh, dear. Ben Thatcher was pretty good. I liked his banter. It was funny. He's a bit out there as well. It was a bit too much for me sometimes, but he was funny. He made me laugh because he used to, well, obviously he was tough going in matches and all that, you know, he'd fly into tackles and sometimes he'd be a little bit over the edge, but it was a good guy, Thatch, and he loved taking Ginola down a peg or two, which is quite funny to see.
I forgot Ginola was there. Of course, Ginola.
Bloody hell. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Ginola was, you know, of course, he's a good-looking guy and all that, and he used to like spend like 30 minutes in front of the mirror after, you know, after training and showering and all that, you know, and so people used to take Mickey out of him a little bit, but Fats tried to take him down peg or two every now and again. It was funny. Can't exactly tell you exactly what he did, but he's sitting in the training ground. but Fats is a good guy, but he liked the prank and he liked doing all that kind of stuff as well. He, of course, he was at Wimbledon as well. So, I mean, he got all that stuff from there. So, yeah, he was a bit lively. I'd say him mainly. But right at the beginning, there was Steve Sedgley and Vinnie Samways and Paul Stewart and, a lot of the guys who were kind of into the band and stuff, Paul Walsh. So there was a lot of that then. Obviously, it started to tone down a bit. And obviously, today, there's not that much at all.
So let's talk about one of your most successful, which is your League Cup final win in 1999. How was that? The build-up to that, obviously, been at Wembley. It's the first major silverware in a while for Spurs at the time. Tell us about that experience. And because a lot of people we've spoken to have won a cup or a league. No one celebrated. Because everyone's had a game after or a game after something happened. So no one actually got the time to have a real celebration. Did you get a chance after the game also to celebrate? And how was the whole experience from start to finish?
It's a huge, especially for Spurs. You know, we didn't win anything since, I think it was like 7 or 8 years before that. So we managed to get there. And then it was, the expectation, obviously going into a cup final, you don't want to lose. But we'd been on a good run because I think George was a manager. George Graham was a manager, and then he'd come in and he'd really, although there was a lot of, you know, a lot of the fans didn't agree with the appointment, he'd really come in and sorted out the whole defensive structure of the team. So we were on a really good run, and it was one of those times when we had like 8 clean sheets in 12 or 13 games, something like 8 clean sheets in 12, something like that. We were going really well. I think we were already in the semi-final of the FA Cup as well at that point. So everyone was pretty confident and we were playing well. We had a lot of 1-0, you know, 1-0 wins and stuff. But we were just a lot more solid, which we haven't been for years. And just came at the right time. And the occasion was obviously great. You know, all the fans there and everything and being at Wembley and the whole bit. It's a massive build-up. And then, you know, once the game kicks off, you're into it. You know, you're concentrating and it's just like, you know, another, pretty much really is another game because you're just focused on your job. And and of course, we went down to 10 men. And then we just nicked it in the last minute. So it was just an incredible way to win. After thinking, you know, down to 10 men, oh, we just got to try and hang on here. We actually did all right, and then, you know, broke away and scored, and then once we scored, like, we knew it was over, and it, like, well, probably had like a minute left, so, you know, you knew it was over and you could just enjoy it, even though that, you know, there was only a minute left, you pretty much knew we were going to win it. So yeah, just incredible, and incredible to know that, you know, you can to win something with Spurs, haven't been there so long, and, you know, ups and downs and everything else that goes on, and to finally win something was great for everybody. Everyone who's been there, you know, because a lot of guys there have been there a long time as well. So it was great for them. And yeah, kind of a sense, obviously a sense of achievement after so long that it was all worth it, you know.
Yeah. What was the, in terms of after that, obviously soon after, not soon after, but fairly soon, you was moved on. Did you ever think, was any transfers talking between leaving to Leicester, go to Leicester in at Spurs? Was you ever linked to be moved anywhere else, or any bids come in that you knew about that it was turned down?
No, early on in my career, I was linked with Lazio, but I don't know what that was. And then I think there was one in Newcastle. I never heard anything. I didn't get anything from the club or from my agent at the time. So I think, I don't know what it was. Maybe, I don't know who put it in there or why. It wasn't me. So I don't know. Because, you know, sometimes the agents put stuff in, but my agent didn't know anything about it. I was like, okay. Sven-Göran Eriksson was at Lazio at the time. But it was just like a rumor, so I don't know. As far as I'm aware, no. And then when it came to leaving, I basically wanted to play at that point because I think I was 29 when I moved, and I just wanted to play because obviously the club had brought in Neil Sullivan, and then, you know, he played the year before and he did well, and I was like, I don't want to sit on the bench again for another year. You know, so I just spoke to Glenn Hoddle and said, look, you know, this and that. And it was all fine. No problem. Spoke, it was all very good. He understood. And then Leicester came up. So I thought, yeah, it's a good move. They're a solid team. You know, they've got a good squad, and I'll have a chance to play. I knew before that Tim Flowers had a problem with his hip. So, yeah, if Tim was fit, it probably would have been another story. But obviously he had a problem, and that gave me an opportunity to play. So I didn't want my career to have, you know, 5 years sitting on the bench. So I just thought it was the best thing to do at the time.
How does the move work then, the intricacy of it, in terms of, obviously we watch Deadline Day now and it's such a spectacle. Back then, was it literally a case of the chairman rung and he came in and said, well, Leicester have come in for you? And did you have, you said you had an agent at the time. Did an agent scout, does he kind of tout you around to other clubs, or was it more like you saying, well, I want to stay in this division, or I want to stay in this area? How does it all go around from a transfer?
I just said to my agent, you know, try and fly me somewhere.
That was it. Oh, I see.
I wasn't. I just said, try and fly me somewhere and let me know what happens. And I guess he did what he should do, which is, you know, I guess he offered me around a few places and what have you. And he came back to me and said, Leicester want you to go there. They're willing to pay, you know, a little some money. And what do you think? I said, yeah, okay, let's do it. And then within a week or so, I'd signed. So, and went out. I was on holiday, I think, at the time, actually. And then I went out and met them in their pre-season. So yeah, it was like that. I mean, there was no real, I must go there, or I must go this part of the country, or I must stay in the Premier League or whatever. Of course, I wanted to, but if it didn't happen, I would have gone to the Championship. I mean, that's, you know, I just wanted to play, so that was it. But it was a good move. You know, like I said, Leicester was a good, really, really good club, and they had a good squad and everything else, and it was a chance to play in the Premier League, so it worked out well.
Was there any locker room, obviously, because you've been in the same locker room for so many years, what was it like to move to a different locker room, a new experience, a new training ground, new, everything's new. You're 29 at this stage, you're a bit more mature. Was there any initiations or anything, or, you know, because how did Flout, was it Tim, no, who was there at the time, goalkeeper, sorry, did you say?
Tim Flowers.
How was his relationship with you coming in, knowing that you're coming in to replace him? How was that?
Well, let me say this: when I met up with them for pre-season training, I think we were away in Spain or somewhere. So we did our first training session, and then straight afterwards, still in a kit, Tim said to me, "Oh, come up to my room afterwards. You know, just drop your boots off and come in after." I was like, "Yeah, okay, no worries. You know, maybe you want to have a chat or whatever, or just, you know, welcome me in or whatever." So I walked into his room, and there was like eight other players there, and on the balcony they had two big crates full of beer on ice. I was like, oh, here we go. Welcome to Leicester. So that was my intro pretty much to the guys and everybody else, and literally still in our training kit after my first training session at Leicester. So pretty, you know, got to know everybody pretty well straight away, and And
I thought that story was going somewhere else. When you said you walked in there was a balcony, there was eight other lads. I thought it was a very different story was going to come out of your mouth just then.
No. But I actually knew a few of the guys from before, like Frank Sinclair. I knew him from before because he came to the Littleshall trials and stuff as well. So I knew him when he was like from when he was like 14. There's a few other guys that actually travelled up from London as well. Eventually, we used to get in one car and then travel up and down. All the guys there were very friendly and it was like I said, it was really good club to be at. Some talented players. Unfortunately, the first year it didn't quite go as planned, but another adventure really. Robbie Savage is probably the one who likes to talk the most about himself, how good he is and all this kind of stuff, how many Ferraris he's got and all that kind of gear. But actually, you know, the impression you get when you're not, you know, you don't really know him that much and stuff is that somebody who's this arrogant guy who's shouting about everything. But actually, he's pretty quiet. I mean, he's pretty quiet in the situations where I saw him out and about. He was pretty quiet. And in the dressing room, of course, he'd give you a little bit of banter about his, yellow Lamborghini or whatever it is. But, you know, it was pretty harmless stuff. And you get to know him and he's like, yeah, he's quite a nice guy. And actually, all that stuff he says is pretty much, just a bit of fun, really. So that surprised me because I thought, oh, I don't know if I'm going to get on with this guy. But actually, he's a really nice fella. But, the only real bad things, the things that happened in Leicester were obviously the thing that happened in Spain with all the guys and they got thrown in prison, which was a horrible situation for everybody. Obviously, a setup. It was set up, obviously, from, I don't know which paper it was, but it was set up. And everybody got in a bit of a panic there. And, of course, the guys and their families went through a lot, which wasn't very nice. But we, you know, it was just for us, it was just like we were just on a normal, having a night out, having a drink and all that. And we're in a casino and next thing we went back and everyone's laughing and joking and then went to sleep. And the next thing you get woken up and saying, oh, everybody put their passports in and the police point your passports and all that. We're like, what's going on? And it was just a ridiculous situation. So aside from what the good things that happened, you know, that was probably the worst, you know, for the guys and all that, because you know, nothing happened. It was a big setup, and which has been proven now. And that was pretty horrible. And I think Lillian Nallis got. I'm not sure Lillian Nallis actually went out, but Lillian had long hair and I had long hair. So I think they looked at passports. They pulled him out and left me alone. So I'm on the bus getting out of there and he's like stuck in the prison. And I was like, oh my God. That was terrible. But that's the only thing really. I mean, other than usual banter. It was good because actually, like I said, four of our guys used to drive up from London. We used to meet at the services. One of us would drive and we'd hammer it up there in the morning and stop for have a sausage and egg McMuffin before we went training. Every day we were looking forward to that. So that wasn't particularly great for the diet. So that was about it. There's nothing too much. I mean, that was the main thing that happened in Leicester.
That you worked with or played with. Who was just like a genuinely stand-up guy who, you know, you could rely on to need a favour or someone to talk to or anything. It's just really, Kling's been putting card behind the bar, which was very generous. Who's the nicest person you work with?
Gary Mabbott.
Okay.
I'd say Gary Mabbott, early days. Just a really nice guy. Had his, you know, obviously has his own problems and all that he played through. But just a genuine, nice guy who take time to speak every time. If you had a problem, yeah, you could speak to him and, you know, go out of his way to help you and help others. So I'd say him mainly. He's an all-round good egg, as they say.
last, so, question, I would say. A goalkeeper's always known for being or having to be a bit out there, a bit crazy, a bit, you know, loose cannons almost. But you've never come across as like that. Even speaking to you today, you're quite calm, quite relaxed, quite chilled. And you always come across like that in interviews in the past and just your characteristics. Was you different to other goalkeepers, do you think, in that respect? Because everyone says you have to be mad to be a goalkeeper. Would you say that was true?
I'm sure, you know, I have my own weirdness and all that, I'm sure. But I think goalkeepers are a little bit different. Yeah, they are a little bit mad in their own ways. I think if you want to throw your head in places where other people wouldn't, it's just, you know, you have to be a little bit different. But they all have their own little quirks, I think. You know, I mean, talk about people who, like, you look at David James, he has his different quirks as well. You know, look at him. And I think David Seaman was quite relaxed as well. I mean, he wasn't especially like crazy, I don't think. I think he was pretty laid back and liked fishing and played a bit of golf and, you know, liked a glass of wine now and again. And I think that was about as mad as it got. But, you know, you never know. But you never know behind closed doors. But that's how he came across to me. But I think, I just think in general, you got to be a little bit different, you know, if you want to play in goal. You know, to do the things you have to do, and the, that position, like we said at the beginning, is one of you can be the hero, or you can have one mistake, and then you're the villain of the whole thing. So you have to be a little bit different to be able to handle that. So yeah, I guess we're all a little bit weird in our own way.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, Ian. I really appreciate that. We're going to end now just with a quick fire round. So we just ask you a few questions, and just the first thing that comes to your mind, just got to answer it. And they're not too offensive. So I'll start you off with fish and chips or pie and chips?
What was it?
Fish and chips or pie and chips?
Oh, God, that's difficult already. Fish and chips.
Strangest thing you've ever eaten?
Oh, dear. Probably help snake. Yeah,
snake.
Off the top of my head,
snake. Fair enough. Summer or winter?
Oh, summer.
Lampard or Gerrard?
Oh, stop it. Oh man, that's not fair either. oof, blimey. Oh no, that's killing me already. That is all right. Gerrard played for Liverpool only because he played for Liverpool. There you go.
Have you ever dined and dashed?
Yeah.
Anthony Joshua or Fury?
Oh, Fury.
Now the big question is gel or wax on the head. What did you go with?
Gel. gel.
Ian Walker or Mark Bosnich? Who is the better goalkeeper?
Oh my God, that's not right. I don't. Well, you know, I don't think much of that myself. So Mark Bosnich, I'd say.
Ian Walker, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate giving up our time. Thank you so much. And listen, good luck with everything going forward, and I hope it's more success for you out in China, and everything stays healthy. And good luck with your knee operation.
All right, lovely. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Take care. Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say. Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.